Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the podcast, and today I'm speaking with Frank P. Barajas, author of Curious Unions, Mexican-American Workers and Resistance in Oxnard, California, from 1898 to 1961. That was published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2012. Dr. Barajas is professor of history at California State University, Channel Islands, where he teaches courses on U.S., California, the 1960s, and Chicano history. His research and writing focus on agricultural labor in Ventura County, community formation among Mexican-Americans and people of color, ethnic politics, and social justice movements. Another interesting fact about Professor Barajas, he received the Latino Leadership Award in 2014 by El Concilio, right? Family Services, and that's an organization based out of Oxnard. Is that right, Frank?
Correct.
Right. So El Concilio Family Services for his outstanding contributions to improving the quality of life for the Latino community in Oxnard. So hello, Frank, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Great. It's a pleasure. And we met recently at the Sal Castro Conference, and that's where I was introduced to your work. So I'm very excited to have you on the channel, particularly because it's close to home for me. I was born in Oxnard. I think I shared that with you, which is the site of your study. So will you begin our discussion today by telling us a little bit about, you know, your personal background and your pathway to becoming a professor?
Yes. I, too, am a product of Oxnard. I was born and raised here. And parents, my mother worked in the canneries and the industry of agriculture, as did my father. And growing up in Santa Paula, his family was involved in the citrus strike of 1941. Mm-hmm. So that story was always kind of in the background of conversation as I came of age. And so I went to the local schools and high school in Oxnard, and after graduating in 1983, I commuted to Moorpark College, which is about 40 minutes away from Oxnard, and then from there I transferred to Cal State University Fresno, and where I got my BA degree and MA degree in history. And once I finished there, I came back to Ventura County briefly and was able to find a tenure-track position in history at Cypress College in Orange County, mm-hmm. where I taught for 9 years. Before returning back to Ventura County, I was lucky to get a tenure-track position upon graduating from the Claremont Graduate School in 2001. I was able to get a position at Cal State University, Channel Islands, and I've been there ever since.
Great, great. And tell me, Cal State Channel Islands is one of the more recent CSUs, is that correct?
Yes, it's the most recent. Yes.
It's the most recent. Okay, gotcha. Great. Yes. So you were among the kind of inaugural faculty, right, to form the History Department and Chicano Studies program, is that right?
Correct, yes. I arrived there in 2001, and I think the following year is when it opened its doors to the service area in regards to teaching students, along with, I think it was 13 faculty, the first cycle of tenure-track faculty.
Great. That's neat. And to be able to come home, that's just what a privilege, right?
Yes.
Well, we've mentioned that that you're from. We're both from Oxnard. Tell me a bit about then how this project evolved. I'm assuming it came out of a dissertation, but why don't you tell us about that?
Yes. As I was approaching the completion of my coursework at the Claremont Graduate University, I started becoming aware of community studies that were being completed. One of them was Gilbert Gonzalez's Labor and Community. Martha Menchaca wrote a book on Santa Paula regarding, it was titled The Mexican Outsiders. And Gilbert Gonzalez was on Orange County. And then one of my classmates, who was on his way out as I was entering my program, Matt Garcia, did his on the community of Pomona, the Padua Players, right? And
right.
So that was part of the movement in regards to historiography, looking at Chicano history more locally and not so much focusing on Los Angeles, but looking at the community surrounding Los Angeles.
Exactly, right.
So I was asking questions, you know, like I said earlier, the labor struggle of people in Ventura County was part of my family history too. So I became aware of Tomas Amaguer's journal article on the 1903 sugar beet strike. And in Labor History, I think it was published in 1985. And his book came out about 1992, Racial Fault Lines, which had a chapter on that. So I said, wow, Oxnard's on the map here. And Kerry McWilliams had referenced the sugar beet industry. And one of my favorite books is North from Mexico, which I have to reread again. Because it's so important, and he starts the conversation in regards to Chicano studies.
Right.
So I asked my advisor, Vicky Ruiz, who was there at the time, you know, how about I do a history of the Oxnard community in regards to the Mexican-American population? And she said, sounds like a great idea. Go with that. And I did. And over a period of years, I was able to put together a dissertation. So that's the origins of curious unions is kind of following through in regards to what the direction of the historiography was at the time.
Right. And how, let me tell us a little about the title, which I enjoy, Curious Unions, and how that for you came to, I have a particular rootedness in the place in Oxnard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, one of the aspects was, Matt Garcia's book, A World of Its Own, is drawn from a section, if I remember correctly, either from Kerry McWilliams, Southern California Island of Land, but I think it's more specifically with the North from Mexico. And then Douglas Sackman wrote a book called Orange Empire, if I remember correctly. And that's another, that's another phrase that was taken from one of McWilliams' works. So I said, wow, if I want to frame my study and create an argument, what am I going to use? And so I looked at more carefully at North from Mexico and his section on the Los Pepperbaleros, right, the sugar beet workers. He makes a statement, is it was only in sugar beet where you have a curious union between, I forget the phrase, corporations and farmers. Wow, curious union. Yeah, so there's something curious about this particular industry. And I went with that, right, and looking at cross-culturalism between the Mexican community and Asian-American community and European-American communities and seeing how it was a complicated relationship. It wasn't just the us against them, right, dynamic that usually transpires, ignoring alliances, ignoring relationships of support and also conflict. So I use curious unions to pull all my chapters together, and that was one of the early criticisms of, well, not a criticism, but feedback from an editor of a press. So, well, you have an interesting dissertation, but how do all these chapters tie together? So that,
right,
that forced me to think about how is the title going to inform the book. So that's where the curious unions comes from, and I should have been more explicit in the introduction in regards to that. But I do mention, footnote Kerry McWilliams is part of, informing that early consideration of cross-culturalism and alliances and other relationships.
Right, and so that part of the cross-culturalism and alliances that form both within across with workers of different ethnicities as well as within communities is something that's very consistent throughout the book. I was wondering, we are going to talk a bit about some of the chapters in detail, but I was wondering if you could just foreshadow for us what were some of the factors about Oxnard and its economy and its the communities that migrated there. pull some things out for us that make it, that in your mind at least, that make it a bit unique. You know, it's, you're making that, the, you know, your book, the scholarship arose at a time when Chicano and Latino scholars were starting to look outside of LA and really outside of urban communities. So what was it for you that makes Oxnard stand out?
Yes, that's a great question, and it also reminds me, you know, of what, you know, what I was faced with. You know, that's one of the questions that you have to answer, right? How is this work different from any other work, right? And the early historiography, particularly in relationship to labor and community studies, was particularly in Southern California, was citrus. You know, the citrus industry is what was defined this commercial agriculture, right?
And, exactly.
But that wasn't the case in Oxnard. There was citrus in Ventura County, and there was lemon specifically due to the climate in Oxnard. But what really boomed the community and brought people from different parts of the United States and different parts of America and the world, talking about Asia specifically, was sugar beets. And nobody had really written about sugar beets in California. Even the United States, up until a year or two, there was a study done in the Midwest about sugar beets specifically and being the main focus. So that was my contribution that invigorated my writing in regards to complicating our understanding of Chicano history, and also California history in relationship to this industry that had not been written about in detail.
No, certainly, you're right. Citrus has been a very, you know, common theme in particularly the history of Chicanos and Mexican Americans in Southern California. And as you pointed out, a number of works have focused on that. And I, as you mentioned, you know, there wasn't a monograph, you know, length type of work that focused on, you know, sugar beet workers and the sugar beet industry, which I found kind of surprising. As then reading through, you know, the early parts of your book as you're describing, you know, the formation of the town or the industry, because, you know, those that were involved in getting the industry started in Oxnard were, you know, tycoons of sorts, right? I mean, these were captains of industry. I believe you use that type of a phrase and moniker. So can you talk a bit about, you know, those people and I think just, kind of for me at least, how striking it was that there seemed to be a gap in scholarship around what seemed to be a incredibly viable and very lucrative industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, the United States was expanding in regards to sugar production, and the Oxnard brothers were these robber barons of sugar. And so as we have the Carnegies in regards to steel and Rockefeller in regards to oil, you know, Oxnard, Henry T. Oxnard specifically, because there was four brothers, was the kind of the aggressive personality in regards to getting subsidies and getting tariffs to protect the production of domestic sugar against competitors abroad. And we see different refineries then being placed throughout California and also the Midwest, to take advantage of this, you know, federal government protections and subsidies from not only the national government but also state governments. So I got to see parallels in regards to other emerging economies and how it attracted people and diverse populations, and how there were these accommodations and negotiations that had to be made as a result of this. So. Yeah, it was exciting for me. And from there, then other industries would emerge. And I really got to learn how power worked in regards to not just having a specific influence in one system of production, but how they branch out to others. For example, the Oxnard brothers established a company in regards to housing development, right? And the,
right.
the managers then became... city councilmen and mayors, and others would become part of the school district trustees. And so how they began to influence or user influence in different areas of society. And that's not unusual when you look at Los Angeles or you look at Orange County or you look at the LA Times, right, how they have these different interests that are integrated, right? So Great.
No, I was going to say certainly.
That's what got me started and excited.
Well, and what I was started to wonder, because you know, thinking more specifically of ethnicity and demographics, was there something to the production of sugar beets then that brought in a larger proportion of Asian labor, particularly of Japanese workers and others. Carey McWilliams explains this process in a number of his books that, there's a series of, uses of ethnic labor, the Chinese and then, the Japanese and typically the Mexicans, and sprinkled among there were some other groups as well. But typically that's kind of the pattern that follows in Southern California. But it seemed to me at least, that there were a bit more, Japanese and particularly Japanese workers in Oxnard, and that for a while outnumbered, it seems like, the Mexicano population. So was there something about the sugar beet industry, or at least the way they recruited their labor, that made that, the reality?
Not so much what was taking place in the United States in itself. But what was happening in their place of origin in Japan, I mean, these were countries that were going through transformation in regards to the Meiji Restoration, was trying to modernize and militarize, and Japanese farmers found themselves being heavily taxed, right? And many were looking abroad to make a living and start new lives. So there were push factors, in places not only in Japan but also later in the Philippines in regards to this international capitalism that was beginning to accelerate in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and some of them were radical. Some of them were socialists, and others had anarchist views, and they brought this with them. So when they were faced with wage cuts or unfair labor practices, they tapped into that, and as the Japanese were entering, they were entering their time when the Chinese were already excluded.
Exactly.
We see this cycle of recruitment and exclusion, and a recruitment of a new group because of the economy needing cheap and exploitable labor.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And that's something I just thought right after, right when you started speaking about the periodization with the Japanese migration, that this was happening just after the Chinese Exclusion Acts in the 1880s, and also notably before the Mexican Revolution, and even prior to the Mexican Revolution, the serious recession, even depression that the Mexican economy went through, it started, more. Or is it, in-depth and expansive migration, out of Mexico to the U.S., right? So it seemed, right, that was just situated right in there.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that brings up another book that I forgot to mention in the beginning was Deborah Weber's Dark Sweat, White Gold. Mm-hmm. In regards, she looks at these refugees and emigres of the Mexican Revolution coming into California and being central to the San Joaquin Valley cotton strike, right, in the 1930s. And that was powerful for me, Deborah Weber's book, because she challenged the notion that Mexican immigrant workers were led by white unionist radicals, right? Mm-hmm. And the context behind that, that original view that Professor Weber was challenging was that Mexican immigrants couldn't organize themselves.
Right.
They had no agency of their own. They had to be saved by another group and led to the promised land, right? And that wasn't the case, right? They had this political consciousness. They had this radicalization that they brought with them.
Right.
And many of them were militarist in regards to being involved in the revolution and women, and they utilized this history and challenging oppression here in the U.S.
No, certainly. And next to your, the primary theme of the book, which is these cross-cultural unions that form both among agricultural laborers and, industrialists and, the city bureaucratic elite and et cetera, is also the theme of worker resistance. And that's what comes through throughout the book. I mean, the book starts in the late 1890s, 1898 to be exact, and almost immediately within, 5 years, you cover the 1903 strike, and essentially you carry that narrative all the way through up to 1961 when, Chavez had just finished an organizing effort through his work with the Community Service Organization. And certainly, that's definitely the case. And a major story and narrative that comes across in the book is a long history of Mexican worker resistance. And then not just Mexican worker resistance on their own, but particularly in this space, right, how they form, as you say, these curious unions with particularly Japanese laborers or even, if it's intra-ethnic coalitions, with Mexicans, that's also happening as well.
Yes. And within all that, I try to tie it into more national currents that are occurring. For example, as you mentioned, Cesar Chavez coming to Oxnard, more of a national figure of the 1960s, but also to see how the CSO, the Community Service Organization that Chavez was involved in, and his mentor, Fred Ross, participated in and trained the Mexican communities throughout California, was linked also to Sal Alinsky in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So that's what I really wanted to highlight. Another example of a curious union or a curious linkage, right, in terms of the Industrial Areas Foundation in Chicago being linked to, Oxnard, California. maybe not directly, but indirectly through Chavez and Fred Ross.
No, certainly. And I think that's very interesting to think about in, a lot of times in scholarship when we're looking at, trans-regional or, national, even multinational networks, we're typically following capital and, the power that flows from that, whether it's bureaucratic state power, et cetera. But in this way, you've also identified, another narrative, network focused on, social justice that, again, Sol Alinsky's roots in Chicago, had, a number of, touchstones or effects on communities in California in particular, particularly Southern California with Fred Ross and his work with the CSO, as well as even earlier Fred Ross was working in some other, projects, I believe with, I think it was Ignacio Lopez forming Urban Leagues and things of that sort. So,
sure, yes. And his involvement during the Great Depression in regards to the camps throughout the San Joaquin Valley. So there's this web that exists. And these such individuals, had a long history and a long influence on people that, transcended their own lives after they're gone. So that's what I'm trying to highlight,
right,
in my work.
Well, and I want to be a little more self-indulgent here and have you talk a little bit more about the formation of our hometown, because this is something that was really interesting to me. I just assumed, and I've never, read much about Oxnard, to be quite honest, outside of a few articles that touched on these type of labor mobilizations around the early 20th century. And so I just typically presumed that since it was so close to Ventura, that it was, kind of shared this similar history of kind of a, mission town-ish. That Southern California kind of narrative of, the Spanish colonialism following, the establishment of missions, et cetera, and kind of being these small towns that eventually, grow with the influx of capital and white migration. But Oxnard was really quite different. You pretty much narrate and tell that this is an industrial town and how it formed. Mm-hmm. And this is very much due to the Oxnard brothers and their desire to see it. Well, they're seeing an opportunity, right, to refine sugar in that location. So will you talk a little bit more about that and, just that idea of how Oxnard forms as this industrial town and how it starts to pull people together in this way that you describe, these curious unions. What are the curious unions that start to form with the Oxnard brothers and those that come to, work with them to establish this space?
Yes, and it's a good question in regards to Oxnard growing so fast because of the sugar beet industry and the refinery. And it becomes the largest city in the county almost immediately. And so that defines it and its location next to Port Hueneme in regards where, you know, ships come in and dock and on harbor. Then the Southern Pacific Railroad that establishes a spur line there, and that connects it, you know, in regards to its coastline in Northern California and also the Los Angeles region. Makes it a central hub, and not only for the economy and the economies that will merge, but also the bringing in of people, right? People that were, as you know, Kevin Starr emphasizes, they were trying to reinvent themselves, right?
Right.
They're chasing a dream, and at the same time, there are these ideas of boosterism that's closely tied to, again, Kay McWilliams' idea of the Spanish fantasy heritage, and that's really advanced in Santa Barbara, right, with their Spanish fiesta days that take place every summer. So again, I was fortunate. Well, not fortunate. I guess it was just there in regards to what other dynamics were occurring throughout California, and specifically Southern California, and people, diverse people coming in, having to negotiate with each other, right? And they're all trying to assert themselves in the public space, right? Whether it be Chinese New Year celebrations or Obon festivals of a Japanese American community, Mexican American community in regards to Mexican Independence Day, even Irish communities are established, Irish clubs in which Adolfo Camarillo's brother, you know, becomes a member of this fraternal organization, right?
Right, right.
So, yeah, I mean, there was, the issue of curiosity or something that made you kind of wonder, you know, how is this happening? And it challenged the idea of, you know, this kind of this bipolar or you know, white hat versus black hat, the dynamic where it was, you know, you had Mexican farm workers and Japanese farm workers that were working for the company union, right? And were undermining the interests of the larger Mexican community and Japanese community. And you have the Japanese Mexican Labor Association, and in which the AFL gives recognition to the Mexican arm of that association, but not the Japanese.
Right.
Because of the anti-Asian, you know, racism that was in the AFL, and how the Mexican Labor Association or the Mexican arm of that association rejected the AFL affiliation based on that, right? So we're not going to betray our brothers who were with us throughout the struggle. And that's a powerful story there, and people who read the book, they highlight that themselves, right? It's because we have a lot of tension in different ways in our society, and I guess for them, history is gives them hope that, you know, we can work through this.
Yeah, no, in ways, truly, I think the contemporary, at least the, you know, late 20th century, you know, era is seen more as the era of, you know, cross-culturalism and multiculturalism. And I certainly agree with that in regards to, you know, general mass, you know, kind of acceptance of that in forms, right? And particularly in media and pop culture. But what's neat, again, another thing that's neat about your book is it shows the early roots of cross-culturalism in, you know, a space like California, Southern California here, particularly Oxnard. And the role that, you know, workers and members of communities, you know, so workers particularly that were, you know, working with each other, you know, of different ethnicities and races, that then had, you know, these different kind of little ethnic community hubs and start to form these organizations and celebrations. And initially you tried to think, you're thinking, okay, they are forming their little, again, more ethnic spaces that are kind of either self-segregated in ways, but that's not in, there's a form of segregation in Oxnard, and we'll talk about that a bit more. But what you see kind of early in Oxnard is a lot of this cultural blending of people participating in different organizations, supporting each other's patriotic celebrations. And so can you speak a bit about that, about how the formation of those organizations started to blur the lines, as you mentioned, between the us versus ven, you know, stark ethnic divides?
Mm-hmm. Yes. One way in which that was done, they would make these calls in the newspapers, particularly the Oxnard Press Courier, and it was the Oxnard Courier earlier, is making calls in the newspaper for people outside of their own ethnic communities to participate and making them welcome. And you know, people back then, you know, there wasn't much to do, right? And on a weekend, particularly when, you know, automobiles were not so prevalent in the early 20th century. So that was another dynamic. And, you know, sports, particularly baseball and boxing, you know, it invited people to share space, right? And when space was limited in terms of recreational space, so there had to be these negotiations, right? And once these negotiations were made, it forced an examination of other spaces that maybe were not open to everybody in mm-hmm. regards to school segregation, right? And this was another thing that would develop particularly in the middle of the 20th century. And looking at the schools, and by the 1960s, you have the CSO particularly, but also other groups of people beginning to look at the Oxnard schools and see how they're segregated based on geography. So you have this cooperation, cross-culturalism, but also, you know, that the racism that defines much of the county, and specifically Oxnard, is there still. Right? And so I guess the tension in my writing of the book is, how do you emphasize cross-culturalism, but at the same time don't deny
exactly.
or don't overshadow at the same time the existence of white supremacy?
Right, exactly.
And how it works out systematically.
Right, and that's exactly what I was going to say, because it's cross-culturalism that's occurring, but yes, it's occurring within the broader structure of white supremacy, right? So it's not that white supremacy was so totalizing that it prevented any type of cross-culturalism, even between people of color and so-called whites or Anglos or ethnic whites, but that, you know, the dominant form of social and economic organization really did reflect much more the system of white supremacy rather than an egalitarian or even, you know, multicultural society. And I think that's probably maybe a part of the difference between, you can maybe parse this out a bit more for me, the difference between cross-culturalism and multiculturalism perhaps is with cross-culturalism, you know, there is a flow, if you will, between, you know, socialization, you know, across different ethnicities. But it's not on an equal plane, and certainly it's not the norm, right?
Yes, it's not the norm, and it's also not it's not given. You know, it's something that
exactly.
has to be
right.
Worked at, right? And also people have to make accommodations to each other, and sometimes people who hold power don't want to give it up so easily, right? So that's one thing I try to tell the story about, but at the same time is tell the story in a narrative form where I'm not being I'm making the argument by way of the story and not being academic or being I guess I was speaking to Frank Bartke one time over lunch, and he brought this up because he said, yeah, so how do you make an argument but at the same time just tell the story, right? And that's
right.
I guess telling the argument more implicitly, that's what I'm getting at. I'm implicitly telling the argument, but at the same time through way of a story, and that's what I try to do, and limit my use of more academic language at the same time, which is sometimes I feel I have to use because that's what people do at conferences, but I don't feel comfortable with.
Right, right. No, I agree with that. And that certainly comes across. You know, there is a sense of, I think, so some of, maybe these are some of these academic words, but, you know, there's a notion of agency that's involved here, but it's also understood that that's happening within structures but that, you know, contingency is there. So you're not being overly prescriptive in this narrative saying this is exactly the way relationships occurred. Either things were excessively, you know, cross-cultural, you know, again, totalizing, you know, the being, you know, separatist or segregationist. But it really was a mix of the two. And you really start to get into that, I think, a really good chapter that addresses that is a third chapter, which talks about the curious union of economic integration and spatial segregation, within this rurban space. And I say rurban, I think that's another phrase from Kerry McWilliams, right? It's a combining of the urban and the rural, showing a space that's in between. Is that correct?
Correct, yes. And where, you know, Oxnard and communities like Oxnard, we're not rural and strictly agricultural, but at the same time, Oxnard was not the big city like Los Angeles. It was an in between community in which people worked in various industries of agriculture, but at the same time, they lived in an emerging urban environment, right? And that's what I brought up. And the chapter three is called Segregated Integration. And I went to years back, there was a commemoration of the Mendez versus Westminster case. And one of the panelists that spoke was Gilbert Gonzalez. And he spoke about the issue of how places like Los Angeles and places like Orange County, you know, they were integrated spaces. Or I think he used the word segregated, integrated places. And I go, wow, this doesn't make sense to me. What does that mean?
Right.
Well, at the same time, you're having integration. You know, you have... the workplace is integrated to a certain extent, right? But the living spaces, the residencies, you know, the schools are segregated, right? Mm-hmm. So you're having both at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what that's another aspect of this, you know, curiosity. You know, how is this happening? You know, you can't have Mexican schools in which, you know, there are limited resources, right? So then you would have, you know, schools within schools, right? Enriched.
Exactly.
They seem integrated.
Right.
But within the schools and classrooms, they're segregated at the same time. So.
That's right. It's my work as well addresses Orange County and picks up somewhat from where Gil Gonzalez leaves off. But you're exactly right in pointing out what I've noticed about Southern California is this mixture of integration and segregation, and that was that I think was very particular to Southern California agriculture and the way it developed, but that was different definitely than other places, particularly either in Texas for the ethnic Mexican community or even in the South for African Americans, where you have, I think, more stark lines. Again, that's not ever to say that there was never any crossing that did occur.
Yeah.
We know that there's tons of scholarship that covers that in all places throughout the United States, but that there was this really interesting and perplexing mixture of integration and segregation. As you said, sometimes it happened within a school, it happened within the building, right? So the building itself, the school itself, because of limited funds, a community may only have one school, but within that school, under its roof, right, there was segregated classes, and there was even a different type of instruction, you know, for children of different ethnicities.
Definitely. Yeah. And listening to the oral history interviews, forced me to look at these complexities, right? When people would say, for example, one person in the book is Robert Vias or Bob Vias, and, you know, he detailed, you know, back in the earlier 20th century or the 1940s and 50s, you know, there are two types of work, right? There's work in the shade and work in the shade and work outside the shade, right? And that's how that dynamic had a racial component to it, right? Where it was the Mexican workers were out in the sun, right? And usually the managers were working in within the factory, at least early in the beginning, right? And this become more nuanced as the 20th century moves in to the latter 20th century. But how, you know, again, the complexity and the progression and the transformation of the community was one thing that I always try to explain and not give a kind of a more black and white dynamic to it or narrative, if I could use that term there.
No, certainly. We've been talking a bit about the community and the way it formed, again, Oxnard being an industrial town, and it forms, essentially, there are about four Mexican barrios or enclaves that, you know, get positioned throughout the town. Some of them, portions of it being like the adobes, being specifically built by ABSC, you know, the sugar refinery, right, as company housing.
Yeah.
And they saw that really as this benefit, right, that, as an attract, you know, to attract the type of workforce and the quantity and stability of the workforce that they wanted, right? Because labor, sure. labor was always, I mean, as it is in a number of agricultural towns, I think it was always really a primary driving concern, right? In Oxnard, how to manage the necessary amount of labor and keep that on hand, right? For the, you know, the fluctuations of the season and the different types of crops.
Yeah.
And so that's doing more with the community, how it starts to form in this mixture of integration and segregation. In the middle of the book, you also get to a series of strikes, you know, in labor type of, you know, movements and resistance. And particularly you cover the 1903 and 1933 sugar beet strikes. And then there's also a strike, and I believe it was more of a citrus strike in 1941. Is that right?
Correct. Yes.
So can you walk us through, and you know, it's kind of a, you know, jump, if you will, in time, but there are differences between these movements. So will you, you know, these particular labor strikes, will you highlight those for us? Let us kind of walk us through that little history there between 1903 and 1941, how yeah. Mexican workers are resisting, and what's the significance of each one of those moments?
Yes. Well, you're forcing me to think about things I hadn't even thought about in a while, and maybe for the first time right now is that one of the differences that, you know, just the product itself, you know, from in 1903 and 1933 is, you know, these are sugar beets, right? And mm-hmm. and how in Oxnard they largely, you know, we have lemons in Oxnard, and the strike is involved not only in the citrus strike, but it's a countywide citrus strike. So Oxnard is part of a larger labor movement that is occurring. And it's not just happening in the orchards. It's mm-hmm. happening predominantly in the packing houses of citrus, right? That's another difference. And where there was more, how would you say it, more of an integrated struggle in 1903 with Japanese and Mexicans, you know,
right.
in 1941, it's predominantly a Mexican working class movement, right,
or
struggle that emerges. And so those are, you know, a few different aspects of these strikes and how it serves to later, you know, attract the notice of the United Packing House Workers of America in the 1950s as they're beginning to struggle against the industry of citrus, move the packing sheds into the fields and orchards, right? And so they feel threatened because they're protected by labor law, in terms of enjoying protection in the packing houses. But if they're moving packing sheds into the fields, they're losing protection there. So how the United Packing House Workers of America saw that, well, Oxnard has this tradition here and has a strong labor legacy there. And it's how we have, you know, Sal Alinsky, and I'm forgetting the president's name of the United Packing House Workers of America, but they look at Oxnard as serving. Yes, Ralph Hellstein, right? They look at Oxnard as a place to build a labor movement by first creating these social networks and services under the CSO to create this network of unionism or organization to later hand off to the Packing House Workers of America. So sugar beets being one product, and later on in the 1940s, we're looking at citrus. Sugar beets primarily on the Oxnard Plain, even though sugar beets was, you know, was being grown all throughout California, specific Southern California. But by 1941, the labor struggle becomes a county struggle, in which you see, different individuals, personalities and groups unite to fight. Another robber baron, if you will, is, you know, Charles Teague, you know, of the Sunkist Corporation, and who founds the Associated Farmers, which is an organization. Many label it as a vigilante group organized and developed to bust unions.
Exactly.
So that's another thing in regards to that difference that occurs, and how Charles Teague is, he's like the Oxnard brothers before him, or I mean, they kind of overlap also. You know, they were influential not only in the industry, but also using their economic might in regards to laws and also the politics and the federal government's force in it, which really is exposed with the Bracero program, in which Cesar Chavez challenges in Oxnard and Ventura County in 1958-59. So that's
yeah, no, I agree, and I think that's one of the neat things, and it's coming together better for me now as you're talking as well. That, you know, these three different strikes, and then later the struggle, you know, against the Bracero program with Hellstein and Chavez and the CSO, you know, that signals these major transitions both in the industry itself, you know, the primary, you know, the driving crops that are driving the agricultural industry in Southern California, I mean, at least in Oxnard. First, it is the sugar beet industry, and it's these, you know, Robert Barron's type, you know, capitalist tycoons that form that industry there and, you know, again, have deep pockets, deep connections into, you know, state and federal bureaucrats, you know, to get the okay, my mind's going blank here. The you know, there's a certain type of benefits that they are in need of to establish the industry, and then that transitions, you know, after the 1930s, really into the 1940s with the citrus industry, and you know, that also the ethnic composition of that workforce is changing. So in 1903, like I said, it's that rare moment when you see this real cross-cultural, you know, solidarity between Mexicans and Japanese workers, even, you know, outside the bond, you know, the issue of class, because you have the, you know, both the workers themselves, and then you have the labor contractors that are coming together and, you know, fighting the refinery and, you know, their attempt to reduce both of their, you know, influence, you know, and particularly the pay, and that becomes kind of the unifying structure for that moment in 1903, which in 1933 isn't as successful. Part of that has to do, right, with the depression, and excess, instead of having a lack of labor or shortage of labor, you can have an excess of labor. And so it makes that cross-cultural and cross-class coalition a little bit more difficult. And then, as you mentioned, in the 1940s, it's now primarily Mexicano working, labor force in citrus, in, I believe the strawberry industries, established by that time also. Is that correct? It's mostly citrus, though. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right?
You're correct.
So you have this, you know, the transitioning of crops that's occurring. And then the 1940s, as you mentioned as well, you have, you know, the Bracero issue, which starts slowly in the, you know, the early 40s. But then, you know, by the middle, the end of the war, really, you know, Oxnard becomes what this, you know, central place and site for Braceros. Mm-hmm. In fact, what has one of the, or the largest camp, Bracero camp in the country, right, is established in Oxnard?
Yes, correct. The Buena Vista camp, and how, you know, the Bracero program, you know, highlighted or intensified divisions within the Mexican community itself, and that was multi-layered. So you had the Bracero, who could be the most recent male immigrant population. Then you had a Mexican immigrant population that was more familial and long-term. You know, had a longer existence of residence. Then you had the Mexican American generation, as we kind of identify as another group. And then by the early 1960s and the mid 1960s, you had this emergence of a kind of the Chicano generation. So the Mexican community itself is, you know, has these different populations within it, right? And they have different allegiances or different levels of allegiances to each other, right? I mean, just because you had long-term Mexican immigrants that maybe were competing for the same jobs or being displaced by Braceros, there was this empathy and sympathy for them, as, you know, these are our brothers who are being exploited, while at the same time they're complaining because they're being a bit displaced by them, right? And these are the sorts of dynamics and complexities that have to be looked at carefully and explained, right? And for example, Cesar Chavez's opposition to the use of undocumented immigrants, right? And the language he uses for that, which was a language For example, one term being wetback, right? And this was a term that was used by the GI Forum. This was the Mexican American GI Forum. This was a term that was used by Ernesto Galarza, who was an immigrant himself, right? Who challenged the Bracero program just as a system of oppression and others and Cesar Chavez. And because their organizing was being affected by the introduction of undocumented immigrants by the industry, right? And this is still a topic of discussion in 2016, right? So I think we can use the history as a way of understanding and informing these sorts of complexities and other forces of time.
No, I completely agree. I think that's one of my biggest draws into history. It's I see so many parallels, you know, with the present and the past. I think that's one of the things initially spurred my interest in history, and particularly in the moments that we're talking about here, these different strikes that happen along the Oxnard Plain, highlighting the shifting of industry, the shifting of, you know, workforce, you know, politics around it as well. You have all these moving parts and players, you know, but there are some, you know, again, the issue of, you know, worker exploitation, you know, is the constant throughout, right? The power of capital and industry, its influence to both organize, you know, and structure space as well as rights, privileges within the communities. I mean, all of these are constants, and they continue even up to our day. You know, as you mentioned, within the 1940s, the big issue really becomes the braceros, and particularly it's this issue of how the labor is contracted and how these, you know, the Farmers Association, the Associated Farmers, that is Ventura County Farmers, Associated Farmers, really find ways to circumvent, you know, find loopholes, not even loopholes, but really just circumvent the law, right? Then they figure out ways to block out domestic workers. And so this is the issue. Sure. This is the context that Cesar Chavez comes into. I loved the chapter of the title of the last chapter, 6, which is Creating Cesar. And that's why I wanted to pretty much round out our discussion here, is if you could, explain that. You know, what was it about Oxnard? You know, how did that create the person that we've, you know, come to know, you know, both in myth and reality? There's been a lot of recent scholarship on Chavez. So tell us a little bit more about, you know, his time in Oxnard. What do we learn about Cesar in Oxnard that perhaps maybe we didn't know, or you haven't known as clearly as you discuss in that chapter?
Yes. Well, one is that, you know, his early childhood was in Oxnard for a moment in time, but it was one of the places in which, you know, he moves from rural Arizona and he comes to Oxnard. That's this urban environment, right? And he understands that this is a different place. You know, it's not Los Angeles, but you know, La Colonia, in which he stayed with his family, has been identified as a pressure cooker, right? And and he details that. In the Jock Levy book, in regards to the autobiography of a movement, right, in terms of his biography, right, he understood that this was a tense place to live, and so they leave, but he comes back, and he details sugar beet work as, you know, being one of the more brutal forms of agricultural work. In the Jock Levy book, he details it as almost like being nailed to the cross, you know, being crucified. And even though he tends to exaggerate in particularly in terms of numbers and marches at times, but that struck me. And he comes back to Oxnard, and as a community organizer, and this is where the Creating Cesar comes from. He comes in as a community organizer, but his struggle ultimately against the Bracero program transforms him. He moves away from being a community organizer to being a labor organizer,
right?
Because the CSO didn't want to go that direction. You know, they wanted to maintain in terms of being community services and empowerment, and where he wanted to make it, he wanted a union arm, he wanted a labor arm of a CSO, and they wouldn't do it. So he left. He left to create his own union, right? And that's where That's where the title comes from, you know, creating Caesar and, you know, utilizing Roman history too, and like, hail Caesar. You know? So I had to, you know, part of the book and part of each chapter, you have to make it you have to make it enticing to read, right? And,
right.
And that was my way of doing that. You know, this is Caesar in transformation. And he takes the Oxnard experience, and he goes to the San Joaquin Valley in Delano with it, right? And that's what I try to do in the concluding chapter as a result of his experience against the agricultural industrial complex, right? And in which Ernesto Galarza identifies and begins to define, and Caesar, Cesar Chavez takes it into the San Joaquin Valley in regards to fighting Goliath.
Yeah, and in regards to particularly also with Oxnard and why Oxnard, because as you mentioned, he was in the San Joaquin Valley before. He was in, you know, he was in San Jose and helped to establish the community service organization there, became, its most successful organizer, and seemed to really be quite happy. And then it's the collusion, if you will, maybe that's the wrong term, of Alinsky, Ross, and Hellstein, who developed this plan, and I think it's named the Hellstein Plan, that's essentially they identified Oxnard, and particularly the United Packing House Workers. Hellstein, he's leading that, right, as a site to make an attack, I think it is, right, on the Bracero program. And that's particularly their target. They want to attack the ways in which the growers and the Farmers Association are systematically violating Public Law 78 by not hiring domestic workers. And so Oxnard becomes a place where that they really focus their interest. And what seemed to come across more in this chapter than I've read in a few other recent books on Chavez, and maybe it's just because I missed it, but it seems here that Chavez was reluctant to go to Oxnard. Right, and he was even reluctant. Maybe even it seems to me here to go and organize farm workers. Essentially, that he was happy as a community organizer. That's what he wanted to do. I'm not saying he didn't have sympathies for farm workers, but at that point in San Jose, it didn't seem like that was necessarily his big push.
No,
is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And he was reluctant and he was questioning, it's almost like, why me? And what can I do? Right. And even to the point where it took him a while to accept the fact that the Bracero program was an issue.
Right.
With the community, right? He was holding his house meetings and looking at his archive in Detroit. And looking, reading newspaper articles and looking at the Jack Levy books and other biographies of him, he seems to be questioning, they're telling me this about Braceros, but, there's got to be something else to it, right?
Right.
to the point where, he's almost, cannot deny it anymore. And, so he is reluctant. He doesn't want to go that way because that's not what he's about. And I think that aspect of wanting to have an organization that was, and this was brought up in the recent historiography, that he has the United Farm Workers Union, but he's really not interested in a union. He's interested in something much more loftier or community based, right? So I think he reverts back to being a community organizer at the end than he is a kind of a labor leader, right? And because he doesn't want to be. Maybe it's the wrong term to say bothered with the day-to-day duties and minutia of labor organizing, right? Mm-hmm. The details, right? He wants something much more grander, and I think that's part of the downfall of the United Farm Workers Union, that the labor component, the labor organizing, the nuts and bolts of labor organizing was really not what he was interested in.
Right.
He's more interested in elevating the community.
Right. Yeah, he was much more interested, you're right, in forming in the recent works on Chavez particularly bring this out. His interest really was in a poor people's movement that was his struggle within the CSO. He saw, right, it's more middle class focus. It was really bothersome and troubling, and one of the primary reasons why he initially left.
Yes.
And was part of his grumblings while he was within that organization. So that certainly that fits into that. The other thing I wanted to highlight, because there seems to me there's these two parts. You know, it's within Oxnard when he – his time in Oxnard when he decides to commit himself to farm workers. So that's one part of it, right, kind of to use his community organizing tactics to organize farm workers. And he becomes really passionate about that. And when he leaves Oxnard, that's what he wants to do, is work with farm workers. And then the other thing is, however, that, you know, Chavez comes into Oxnard – already with a built, with a pre-built infrastructure, if you will, of, you know, Mexican American, both a history of resistance, but then of community organizing. And so can you speak, for that for a couple of minutes, just how all the work that had been done really in the previous, say, 40 years or, you know, more so like 50, 60 years to Chavez getting there, sets the stage for him to essentially, you know, not saying he didn't, you know, he did come in, he worked hard, but he was able to plug himself in with a network. You know, there, for example, there was the Oxnard Civic Improvement Association, right, that was already there. And that essentially becomes the CSO, you know, just it's almost like a name change to some extent, right?
That's
so he essentially gets to plug himself right in there. But that wasn't it. You know, there was a lot more, a much deeper history of labor and community organizing in Oxnard that made what happened there possible.
Yes. And in regards to Mutualistas, in regards to like the Oxnard Civic Improvement Association and the baseball clubs that exist, the Oxnard Aces that existed, and the veteran citrus workers, agricultural workers, labor organizers that were in the county still, you know, yes, the foundation was there, and that was important. It is important in regards for students of history. And when I say students of history, I mean students who are all people who are all interested in history, but specifically people that are in the schools, whether they be the teachers and the college professors and college students, to recognize that, you know, yes, Cesar Chavez was important, but I wanted to move away from the great man theory or historiography, right? Uh-huh. And look at how Cesar Chavez was part of a larger movement in which, you know, he was really we highlight, but we shouldn't ignore that, you know, there were people that were sacrificing their daily lives to improving and elevating the interests of the community as a whole. And even after Chavez leaves, you know, the CSO still exists in Oxnard, and it goes countywide, and you see the La Raza Unida party emerge later on in the 1970s. And so that the economic condition doesn't change much. So the community still has to organize and struggle, right? In various ways. And that's one of the takeaways I wanted people to leave with, right? And that's what I'm trying to do now in regards to looking at the Chicano movement in Ventura County, to see how, you know, it didn't end with Chavez leaving, right? It continues, and he comes back as citrus strikes emerge in the 1970s, but he comes back more as a supporting role rather than in a leading role,
right?
And so that's what I'm looking at.
Well, that's great.
He becomes a figure, right? He becomes a figure for college students, right? In Moorpark College, Ventura College, and UCSB, UC Santa Barbara, UCLA. He becomes a national figure of a person that's leading poor people to a better life, right?
No, I think that's right. I see so many parallels, the African American Civil Rights Movement, Black Power Movement, particularly with the symbolism of King and other movement leaders and much of the, you know, recent, works in those fields as well have pointed out very similar things, right? That, you know, for example, with Selma, right? That, Martin Luther King comes into Selma, and thanks to SNCC, you know, and other organizers, right? He has a network that he's able to plug into that, you know, like that's Chavez, right? You know, they had already been doing voter registration, voter education, and that's, you know, essentially some of the things that had been going on previously in Oxnard. And so Chavez comes in, he's able to launch a massive voter registration campaign that's incredibly successful, and they have these successes, and you explained that already, but the parallels to me as well are what's really interesting, that you see this, also, right, with other groups, other movements. And you already started talking about, well, you already really covered my last question, which I was really interested to hear about what you're doing now. And you mentioned more, it's an extension, of the history going forward, more with the Chicano movement, what happens later in Ventura County. Anything else you want to say specifically about this next project and maybe even when we can expect to see it?
Yes, well, I'm shooting for 2000. We're 2016 now. I'm looking for 2019, so 3 years from now. But I'm looking at the development of the Chicano movement in Ventura County in different ways. For example, since Ventura County didn't have a public higher education university back then, you know, looking at the community colleges, you know, how did UMass develop in Ventura College? What were they concerned with, or in Moorpark College, right? And how, what were the intersections of the student movement in these community colleges with the Vietnam War? And where do they go, right? A large number of them go either to UC Santa Barbara or they go to UCLA. So they're plugged into the Chicano moratorium movement, right, in LA, or they're plugged into the movements that are taking place in Santa Barbara. Then I'm also looking at the strikes that occur, one of them being the strawberry strikes. You know, as agriculture becomes more specialized, we have different forms of agriculture, and now we have strawberries, right? And what's the role of the United Farm Workers in these strikes, right? And also not only that, but Salinas, right? And one of the things that happens is that strawberry workers in Oxnard want the same labor gains that were achieved in Salinas in Oxnard, right? Mm-hmm. So again, this trans-regional connection, right? And the issue of segregation, you have the walkouts in Los Angeles. Well, there were walkouts here in Ventura County too. So it's looking at the larger movement, but more locally again. And one of the reasons why this is happening with what I'm doing is because I'm from Oxnard, I'm from Ventura County, and I still live in Ventura County, so I have the luxury, the benefit, the fortune of knowing people who have that history behind them and who are participants and are willing to talk with me, right? And that's one of the points that's, when you write history, particularly a history that relies on oral histories, and you got to have those relationships. You just can't make cold calls, right? And sometimes you do make the cold call, but you have to have somebody that's going to introduce you first, right? Saying, hey, so-and-so, Frank is okay. He wants doing
exactly.
This study. Well, can he talk to you about this? And rather than just somebody out of the blue, right, which I've done too, and not always successfully, right?
No, I feel you. I'm going through the same thing in Orange County.
Is that right?
I don't have the deep connections in Orange County. I was born in Oxnard, lived there till I was 10. Mm-hmm. We moved to San Diego. So really my introduction to Orange County and trying to get in those networks is not as natural, but you're right. There are good people there. And a lot of it does, rely on, those networks. And for me, I'm still very much drawn to community history. I think, there's so much. I think there's a temptation when there's, regional histories. That's part of the movement that we started with that was, launched by those like, Gil Gonzalez and others that started to say, hey, we focus too much on urban LA. Mm-hmm. There's, a lot that has to do with the particularities of space outside of LA. And yes, we acknowledge its connections, but, we need these other histories. And so a lot of work, over the last 20 years or so is really even, I think it's even been more than that since Gil published his book and, the community type histories that were coming out of the late 80s and early 1990s.
Sure.
There's just so much more work, I am completely in agreement that needs to be done because things like this, your book here is another thing just particularly reminded me as I was reading through it and I was able to notice, the differences, between Oxnard and even just, again, LA was just, I'm trying to think the mileage. What it's just an hour south as you drive it, but I'm not even sure what the mileage
is.
And Orange County similarly, just 30, 40 miles ish. I think to Anaheim from downtown LA. So it's they're definitely close spaces, but the differences in the history and the communities and the people and how they experienced it, particularly, which is what these histories mm-hmm. focus on, how the people lived those experiences and dealt with it and responded to it, is there are those important variations that need to be covered. So, all that to say, thanks for your work and thanks for coming on to our channel. I really appreciate the time and appreciate reading the book, getting to learn a lot more about where I came from and, picturing, my family when they were there, which my mom's side of the family were working in those fields. Wow. So it taught me a lot about that place. So I appreciate that. Okay. And certainly encourage our listeners to get a copy of it and read it. And there are a number of interesting points, as we've discussed, and we tried to cover some of them, but there's a lot more. So thanks again, Frank. Okay. I appreciate your time.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, DJ, and thank you for having me on your program.
Certainly, and we'll talk again. Thank you for tuning into New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you have enjoyed my conversation today with Frank P. Barajas, author of Curious Unions, Mexican-American Workers and Resistance in Oxnard, California, 1898 to 1961, again published by the University of Nebraska Press in 2014. If you'd like to contact me, please send me an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com, or feel free to reach out via Twitter and Facebook. Also encourage you to download our podcast and subscribe to it via iTunes or Stitcher.